So tonight we start a new series, and it's a series that is not going to be one that we do kind of several weeks of in a row. It's a series that's going to be scattered throughout this year called Clasping the Heel. It's going to be a series that is a bit like that kind of reminder prompt that you need every kind of, you know, 6 to 8 weeks that just kind of says, remember this again, remember this again. And so this series is going to be following the story of Jacob, or Jacob as he's known in Hebrew. And it's centered around this idea of exploring and wrestling when it comes to being part of God's promises. You see, in exploring these stories, and we're going to kind of pick up kind of 4 or 5 stories in the life of Jacob across the year, what I want us to do is highlight both the dangers and the triumphs of what I would call a discovery mindset, this idea of like wanting more. It's funny because sometimes in church, you know, that idea of wanting more, even that phrase, we might kind of shy away from. More, that sounds kind of consumeristic, or it seems like, you know, arrogant. But actually, when it comes to wanting to participate more deeply in the promise of God, this is something we ought to pursue. And admittedly, with that pursuit comes certain dangers, and yet also comes certain triumphs. But the thing that is consistent is that God meets us and is faithful in meeting us and teaching us as we seek to be passionate rather than passive in what he's doing. And so we're not always going to get it right, and this is a thing to be clear. And certainly as we explore the story of Jacob, he does not always get it right. He's actually a character, if you look at his story, he's kind of a hard one to even reconcile, and we'll explore that over this series. And yet he had this desire to participate in what God was doing. And I suppose I want us to begin by considering this reality that sometimes we all have these kind of things that are precious to us and we struggle with when somebody else has control over. I remember as a kid, the thing for me was my Legos. I used to have my little Lego creations and I put them on my shelf. And I always remember that even when my friends came over, I was so nervous about them even touching my Legos, right? Because like I'd put so much love and care into these Legos, and whenever a kid would grab it, I'd be like, oh no, he's gonna break it. You know, like, and it was bizarre because these were my friends, and yet I'm like, oh, it makes me super nervous. Like as an adult now, like it's my recurve bow. So I do like archery. And one of the things that you're taught the first time you ever pick up an archery bow is don't dry fire. And what that means is if you pick up a bow and it's got a string on it, never try to shoot it without an arrow in it, okay? This is what they teach you. Never, never do it, because if you do, it can snap the limbs. It's not good for you. It's not good for the bow. And yet people just always want to pull it back. They always want to pull it back. And so whenever I hand over my bow to somebody to have a look at, I just am like on edge because they wrap their fingers around the string and they start to pull it back and they just want to feel the weight. And I'm like, don't dry fire it. It's like, do you realize what you have in your hand? Is kind of what we are kind of asked this question of. It's like, do you appreciate what you have in your hands? Whether it be like the Lego or whether it be, you know, the bow. And it doesn't just about stuff. Maybe it is that you've been running a program or a classroom or something, and then somebody else has to kind of take it over for a week. And they're being a little bit too cavalier about it, you kind of feel. Like, you know, it's like, do you realize how much time and effort I've put into this? Please treasure it the way that it ought to be treasured. We all have these kind of moments. And we're going to see a little bit of this reality in this story that we're engaging with tonight. It's like, do you appreciate what you have in your hand, sir? And what we're going to discover is there's going to be 2 perspectives on this matter. And so let's start with the story we have from Genesis chapter 25. We're going to go through this initially, give some backstory to these characters, and then we're going to work through it a little bit at a time. So it says, this is the account of the family line of Abraham's son Isaac. Abraham became the father of Isaac, and Isaac was 40 years old when he married Rebekah, daughter of Bethuel in the Aramean from Paddan Aram, and sister of Laban the Aramean. Verse 21, Isaac prayed to the Lord on behalf of his wife because she was childless, and the Lord answered his prayer, and his wife Rebekah became pregnant. The babies jostled each other within her, and she said, why is this happening to me? So she went to inquire of the Lord. The Lord said to her, Rebekah, two nations are in your womb, and two peoples from within you will be separated. One people will be stronger than the other, and the older will serve the younger. When the time came for her to give birth, there were twin boys in her womb. The first to come out was red, and his whole body was like a hairy garment. So they named him Esau, which means hairy. After this, his brother came out with his hand grasping Esau's heel. So he was named Jacob, or Jacob, which means grasps the heel. Isaac was 60 years old when Rebekah gave birth to them. The boys grew up, and Esau became a skillful hunter, a man of the open country, while Jacob was content to stay at home among the tents. Isaac, who had a taste for wild game, loved Esau, but Rebekah loved Jacob. All right, so you can feel like the tension already brewing at the beginning of this story. And the author is clearly trying to set up this contrast between these posture of these two kind of brothers. And this is something that the author wants us to kind of give deep attention to. They're just like twins, but they're so distinct. I love that there's this kind of mystery, like they're jostling in the womb. Like all the way from the very beginning, before they're even born, there is this kind of wrestling going on. Who's going to be the winner? Who's going to come out first? And even God makes it clear to Rebekah that there will be some unexpected outcomes. That detail, like, for example, that the older will serve the younger. Quite incredible that God chooses to reveal this to Rebekah, which is profound. You presume that she shared that with Isaac, but it actually doesn't say so. But God had somehow revealed to her that in this battle, in this jostling, that there would be some unexpected outcomes. And then, of course, you've got Esau, a man, hairy man of the open country. He'd never dry fire a bow. You know, he knows what's down, right? So you've got Esau who's out there and he's the skillful hunter. And then you've got Jacob who is content to stay home. And then you have this, again, contrast between Rebekah, who was granted this revelation, and Isaac, the father, who loved a good feed, right? So you've got all these kind of contrasts in the story, and it's setting up this tension for how is this thing going to play out. And so what we're going to be doing is we're going to be following these two tracks, because that's what the author wants us to do. We need to follow the track of Esau. We need to follow the track of Jacob and discover what is happening essentially in this moment, remembering that this is part of a much bigger story. Now, back in verse 19 of the passage, it says that this is from the family line of Abraham. Now, for those who aren't familiar with the story of Abraham, Abram, or he was previously known as Abram, God called him, right? He had called him and revealed himself to Abram and with this promise. He said, go from where you are and I will essentially bless you. And because I will bless you, your call is to bless the entire world. This is the beginning of Judaism, essentially. He is the father of the Jewish nation, Abraham. And so there is this sense in which this kind of contrast and this tension that's being set up isn't just about some debate between two brothers. This is actually significant because God had provided Abraham with this profound invitation to discover and live out who he is, right? That's the invitation that God extended to Abraham and then to his son Isaac, which was then going to be extended to Jacob and Esau. So this isn't just about some little tussling. This is about God's bigger story. Remembering that this invitation that was extended to Abraham and then to Isaac and then to these sons is the very same invitation that we are invited to share in today, right? So this is not an old invitation. It's not even a new invitation. It is the invitation that God has extended to us. And so let's have a look here in verse 29. This is how the story continues. We've got this tension. We've got this setup. Let's see what happens next. Once, when Jacob was cooking some stew, Esau came in from the open country, famished. He said to Jacob, quick, let me have some of that red stew. I'm famished. That's why he was also called Edom, red. So apparently he liked red things too. He's hairy and red, okay? Jacob replied, first, sell me your birthright. Verse 32, look, I'm about to die, Esau said. What good is the birthright to me? But Jacob said, swear to me first. So he swore an oath to him, selling his birthright to Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau some bread and some lentil stew. He ate and drank and then got up and left. So Esau despised his birthright. So we've got this big story. They've got this tension, and then we've got this big story. Somebody is, or two of these guys are going to inherit this Abrahamic promise, which is about God inviting them into his story. And we see two different responses to this. But first, to understand this, we have to understand this concept of birthright, because that's not something we really talk about nowadays. Now, the birthright is what's known as the Bahor. Okay, the Bahor is the oldest son of the family. If you are the one who is born first and you are the son in ancient Near East tradition, you are what's known as the Bahor. It looks like Bachor. It's not. It's Bahor. And the Bahor is the firstborn. And the Bahor is first and foremost the sole carrier of the primary responsibility to carry on the legacy of the father. So whatever the legacy of the father was, the Bahor was responsible for carrying that on. So whatever the father does, whoever the father is, whatever the father stands for, whatever kind of practices that father has adopted, that has become the value system for that family, it's the firstborn son who's going to carry that on. This is a significant role. Now, the Bahor also gets some additional resources. See, while a father with his children, particularly his sons, where the resources would be distributed upon his death, right, and they'd be distributed to his children, the Bahor would get a double portion, right? So if there was four kids, the Bahor would get two portions, and the others would share in the other parts, right? But it wasn't just a double portion of blessing, it was a double portion of responsibility. Because those extra resources were there so that they could continue on the mission, so they could continue to represent the father's will even after his passing. And so it was a double portion, but it was also double responsibility. And as the Bahor, most people considered this to be the most incredible privilege, an absolute honor to be the firstborn. And yet, what do we see from Esau? What do we see in terms of his response to this invitation to carry on the mission of God that his grandfather had been bestowed upon and then his father had been given? What we see from Esau in this first response is essentially indifference. It's indifference to the legacy and the responsibilities that come with being the Bahor. You see, only through God's providence and grace, not through his own efforts, of course, was he given this opportunity. It wasn't like that Esau earned his Bahor status. It was just providence and grace. He happened to come out of the womb first. And yet, Esau simply wasn't interested in it. I mean, Jacob's like, hey, first sell me your birthright. And he's like, oh, I'm about to die. What good is the birthright to me? And I think this is a real challenge for us to reflect on, particularly for those of us who have had the incredible grace of growing up in the faith, growing up with an understanding of what it means to trust Jesus, with that invitation to again discover and live out who God is. See, the challenge actually sits with us. It's like, do we want it? Do we appreciate it? Do we understand what we have in our hands? Because some of us don't realize what a privilege that is. I think about my own story, and some of you will have heard this before, and I won't go into too much detail, but the reality is, like, I didn't grow up in a family or have a long legacy in my family of people who trusted in Jesus. In fact, my parents only were introduced to Jesus and put their trust in Jesus about 4 years before I was born. And so we didn't have this like long line of legacy of faith. My parents were working out what it looked like to trust Jesus at the same time they were raising, at the time, my sister and me. And it was amazing, right? Because they were learning and I was learning and they were trying to practice it and I was trying to practice it. And they were discovering this kind of ethic and sacrificial love of Jesus and trying to live out that in truth. I mean, what a grace I consider that to have been. That I actually was blessed with the opportunity to be exposed to that truth, to learn about stories from the Bible, even like this one, from a young age. to know that love, joy, peace, blessed to be a blessing, like this kind of stuff was sowed into my life from an early age, and I don't want to take that for granted. I was chatting with someone just last Sunday, actually, and they were talking about someone who they were seeking to kind of disciple and grow, and this particular young person came from a family, and his particular words that he said, you know what, when I look at my parent, I've got nothing to imitate that is good. And so I've had to learn my own ethic. This is what this young person said, probably 16 years. I've had to learn my own ethic because when I look at my parents, I just have nothing to imitate that looks like what you guys are doing here at church. And it broke my heart a bit because there's this sense of like, man, seriously. Sometimes we're given these opportunity to experience God, and yet, you know, do we respond with indifference or do we respond with a desire to pursue Him? I mean, working with young people, I think this is just a constant refrain for me. You know, you sit with them on a Friday night and you try to speak life into them and you share some love and share some hope and you try to sow some seeds of significance and truth in them. And that's okay, because when I was their age, I probably didn't appreciate it as much as I do now, right? And that's okay. But we want to make sure that we do in time. Appreciate what we've got in our hands. Because what we see in Esau is somebody who had this incredible opportunity to discover and live out who God is, and yet he just didn't care. And I think it's a warning to us, particularly in this verse 32 here, that when we are tired or when we are struck with different temporary priorities, that's when we're most likely to give away that which ought to be treasured. You know, he's coming in from the field, he's hungry. There's something kind of visceral that he needs in that moment. And because that was the overwhelming experience for him, he neglected that which ought to be treasured. And we don't want to do that in our lives. There's great things in life, but we don't want to prioritize something over the mission of God, which ought to be integrated into those amazing things that we are doing. And so that's one response that we see in this contrasting image of two brothers starting with that wrestle in the room. The first brother, Esau, the Bahor, responded to that opportunity with indifference. And yet we see a second brother. Let's read this and unpack it. Again, when the time came for her to give birth, that's Rebecca, there were twin boys. The first came out red, hairy, named Esau. After this, his brother came out with his hand grasping Esau's heel, so he was named Jacob. Now, it's interesting here because there's two kind of Hebrew translations for this name, Jacob. One is grasps the heel, but if you read in your text notes of your Bible, you'll also note that it'll say, this is also an Hebrew idiom for he deceives. Now, not many people are going to name their kid He Deceives. I just want to be clear about that. It's very rare if you're raising a child as you're going to name them after something bad, because a name had carried significance. It was actually about setting trajectory. Nevertheless, it's most likely that because of Jacob's story, the old clasp the heel, that over time this Hebrew idiom developed, because he was quite a deceptive person. Now, he was shrewd. And that cannot be denied, but it also cannot be endorsed. And I want to make that clear. Jacob is not, in every respect, the one we ought to imitate. But in the contrast between him and Esau, there is something that we need to take away. Now, Jacob, who will deceive, ultimately his deception will get him into a whole lot of trouble. But ethics aside and methods aside, I want us tonight to look at his motivation. Because that's ultimately what the author wants us to look at. The distinction between the brothers and what was their motivation in the moment. We see here in verse 29, back into the story, when Jacob was cooking some stew, Esau came in and famished. And he said to Jacob, quick, let me have some of that red stew. I'm famished. And Jacob replied almost instinctively, almost like he was prepared. First, sell me your birthright. Now, to be very, very clear, again, I am not endorsing the way that Jacob went about it. But it is really, really clear here that he wanted to play the role of the Bahor in the family. Like, he wanted it. He actively was pursuing it. His readiness to ask this question, to even have this kind of shrewd sense of negotiation, meeting Esau at his point of need in order to get what he wants. There's evidence that Jacob actually wanted what Esau was given. He wanted to be the one who not only received the double portion, but also the double portion of responsibility. Remembering that this isn't just about, I'm getting extra cash, I'm getting extra resource. It came with really significant responsibility. But Jacob wanted it. And rather than what we see with Esau, which is this indifference, what we see in Jacob is something different. We see pursuit. He's like, swear to me that you are going to give this to me. Like, he was not going to let Esau kind of wriggle out of this with some sort of exception. He's like, swear to me, I'm ready at your point of need, and also I'm not going to let this slide. Remembering, again, right now, he's not trying to gain greater resource because he comes with responsibility. This, for him, was about the role, about taking on that desire to be the Bahor, to carry on the legacy of his grandfather Abraham and his father Isaac. Jacob wishes that he was the one who had Esau's opportunity for influence. That's what's going on here. Again, methods aside, that is the motivation. I mean, we see it here. Look, I'm about to die, Esau said. What good is the birthright to me? But Jacob said, swear to me first. He's like, I am getting this. So he swore an oath to him, selling his birthright. And we're going to see throughout the story of Jacob that he certainly doesn't have it all together. But the thing we do see over and over again is he wants to be in the game. Right? He's gonna fail a whole number of times, but he wants to be in the game. And crazily, that just that desire and that posture of pursuit, God actually meets him in those points and creates these moments of revelation and discovery. We're going to have moments where he's going to suddenly not even realize that God was there, but then God reveals himself in a profound way. Jacob's going to be the one who wrestles with this man who represents God in this mysterious way. It's like Jacob, even with all his deception and all his flaws, because of this desire to be in, God meets him in that place and invites him to take more and more steps forward. And what we discover is that Jacob will go to any lengths that are required. And so in this earliest part of the Jacob story, we already see these two different postures to the opportunity to enter into and embrace God's story. One of Esau's indifference and the other one of Jacob's pursuit. And this is our challenge that I want us to consider tonight. When it comes to being part of this bigger story of what God is doing, this profound invitation to discover and live out who God is, which brother will we be? Because we've all got a choice to make. Whether we're going to dive into the deeper story of God, whether we're going to choose to trust, wrestle, make mistakes, experience forgiveness, like whether we're going to do that with this kind of pursuit mentality, or whether we're not going to treasure what God has placed in our hands and maybe respond with Esau's indifference. But we all need to make a choice. Because this story and this choice also comes with a warning. Notice what it says here in verse 34. Then Jacob gave Esau some bread and some lentil stew, and he ate and drank, and then he got up and left. So Esau despised his birthright. Now, when you look at the various interpretations of this word despise, there are two major ones that come out. First of all, this word despised can be interpreted as a description as to how Esau neglected his birthright. Like, he despised it. He gave it no credence. He gave it no value. That's where that indifference was. He didn't treasure that which he had been graced with. But there is also a second interpretation, and that is the interpretation of regret. It's like from that point on, he despised his birthright. Whenever he thought of his birthright, when he thought of what he had given up as the Bahur, it only brought him pain. It's almost like he regretted what he missed out on. Whenever I think about these moments, I think about the song Big Yellow Taxi, and if you don't know it, that's okay, because I've written the lyric on the screen that people know best. You don't know what you've got till it's gone. They paved paradise and put up a parking lot. And this is what Esau's experience of his birthright became. He didn't know what he had until it was gone. And then suddenly, when he realized what he had lost, all that was left was bitterness. I had paradise, and yet I chose indifference. And so who are we going to imitate, Jacob or Esau, when it comes to our motivation, not our methods, our motivation toward God? Later on in the New Testament, in the book of Hebrews, the writer would have some scathing words for this moment. It says in Hebrews 12, 14 to 17, "Make every effort to live in peace with everyone and to be holy. Without holiness, no one will see the Lord. See to it that no one falls short of the grace of God, and that no bitter root grows up to cause trouble and defile many." You can always hear that bitterness that has that potential, right, to not only affect you but affect others. "See that no one is sexually immoral or is godless like Esau, who for a single meal sold his inheritance rights as the oldest son. Afterward, as you know, when he wanted to inherit his blessing, he was rejected. Even though he sought the blessing with tears, he could not change what he had done." Now, if that isn't a warning, I don't know what is. Like, there's this like, you had it, Esau. It was there. But you chose a path of indifference. And then when you wanted to inherit the thing, when you realized, no, it was too late. It's too late. Sought the blessing with tears, but he could not change what he had done. And so I want to challenge us tonight as a wrap up. We all have a choice to make. Are we going to be the kind of people who treasure that which has been given to us and appreciate the grace of maybe our upbringing or the fact that we found ourselves here tonight? Or you're joining us online. You've accidentally stumbled across this. You've still got a choice to make. What am I going to do? Am I going to treasure the invitation that God has extended to learn him and to live out his way? Or am I going to be like Esau, responding to my felt needs of any given moment, my animal appetite, and perhaps in doing so, miss out on the very thing that I'll later come to treasure? Let's consider this for ourselves as I pray. Jesus, we want to be people who pursue you, who seek after fresh revelation, and who want to know who you are and to live out your way, to be blessed to be a blessing. And so, God, I repent of the times when I've taken that gift for granted. God, thank you that you extend it to us by your grace. And that you know us, you know our limitations, that you're so patient in your forgiveness toward us. And so, God, would we not become complacent, but rather engaging with each other, engaging with you through prayer and through study and through wrestling and through pain and through reflecting upon where you're at work, God, may all these things sharpen us as we fix our attention on you. We want to be the people who stand for you. We put our hands up and say, yeah, we're in. And so, God, would you reveal to us what that looks like in our circumstances? The practice we need to adopt, the relationship we need to pursue, the thing we need to stop doing in order to prioritize you. In your name, amen.